Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here, and welcome to the Monday edition of the Wintrust Business Lunch. Did you watch football yesterday? You know, Scott Kleinberg was in last week from the Chicago Tribune, writes about social media, and he was talking about how Facebook is really creating this big push now to be sort of the live content originator or provider. I don't know how you figure it out, but usually, you know, on Twitter, people are having the conversations about events. Facebook wants to get in on that. Jim Dahlke, one of the Inno boys, was playing along with Facebook last night during the NFC Championship game. He'll be along a little bit later, along with Will Flanagan. Always good when the boys from Chicago Inno come by. But first, Frank Sennett is here. Frank, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Steve.
So we're talking earlier about the cloud. You know, everything's going to the cloud, and it's as if it's this sort of ethereal area in the sky. But turns out the cloud is in Franklin Park.
That's right. L.B. Galoon in Crane Chicago Business, chicagobusiness.com, has a big piece this week about how the cloud storage boom is really becoming a real estate boom in Chicago. We have one of the largest capacities for cloud storage in the world. We have a 426 megawatts of capacity that's second only to Virginia with 592, and it's getting bigger and bigger.
All right, so tell me about, what the cloud is, because if you don't stop to think of it, you don't realize that really these are going to these sort of big data processing centers.
Yeah, so it's things like what you're watching on Netflix, that's all stored and streamed from the cloud. More and more companies are running all of their IT operations in the cloud now. In fact, about 12% of companies, and that number is supposed to hit about 50% by 2020. So it's a huge ramp up. And so all that data that you're accessing via your phone more and more often and via your Roku device or your Apple TV is stored in the cloud.
They're saying by 2020, maybe 70% of companies will store their data on the cloud.
Yeah, it is just ramping up very fast.
Okay, so who's the winner there?
So real estate, you got to have storage. The cloud is a nice euphemism, but really there's machines that store all this stuff that need to be cooled and housed properly. There's a 1.1 million square foot former printing plant with 100 megawatts of power next to McCormick Place, for instance, and some that are coming online. You're looking at places like Franklin Park and Elk Grove Village that have excess capacity of some buildings that were, former printing plants, warehouses, that kind of thing, and they're being retrofitted to have these big data centers.
And isn't it the R.R. Donnelly site near McCormick Place? Is that a data center? Do you know?
Yeah, that's the project that's on the books that they're looking to launch a 40-megawatt data center near McCormick Place to be near the one that's already there. It's one of several proposed centers in the city, and that is a former Donnelly plant.
I know that James McHugh Construction, from reading Albie's article, wants to develop not only the site, but then a 50-story hotel adjacent to it. Now, I'm assuming those aren't related, like the hotels for McCormick Place, not so much for the cloud.
Right. That would be my guess, 500-room, but I bet it'll have great Wi-Fi.
I bet it will have great Wi-Fi. All right. So that's sort of at least one positive area when it comes to real estate in the area. The cloud is coming down to planet Earth and
yes.
Franklin Park and Elk Grove Village and elsewhere. The Dow Jones Industrial Average has been coming down to earth so far this year, too. We know that generally. How are Chicago stocks doing?
Well, we've got an analysis in this week's issue looking at the Bloomberg Illinois Index. It's down 8.9% through January 21st. That's compared to a 6.7% decline in the S&P 500. So Illinois companies pretty hard hit by this downturn. All but six of the 144 stocks in the local index have lost ground in this what they're calling a historic rout.
I know that Caterpillar today was downgraded by Goldman Sachs from a watch to a sell. They are down $2.45 today. So I would imagine that's one of the bigger losers of the year.
Yeah, absolutely. And, there's some structural issues there because we've got slowdowns in construction, mining, and oil drilling that are sapping demand for Caterpillar's products, and management expects revenue to slide maybe another 5% next year.
Is it oil that's hurting our Illinois companies, or is it oil and China?
Yeah, both of those have accounted for some of the biggest hits, it looks like. United Continental, that's the oil, that's been down 21%, although you'd think, lower oil prices might help.
Right.
Boeing followed United with a 14.7% drop, and Archer Daniels Midland sank 13%. So those are the biggest losers, but some of the stocks have fared pretty well. McDonald's was only down 0.25%, and they just had a nice earnings report out.
It came out earlier today, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so McDonald's has got a lot invested in China, but apparently the problems in China aren't having much of an impact on the Big Mac.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of hope that the new management team at McDonald's with the breakfast all day and some of the other initiatives are really kind of turning the corner for McDonald's overall, and so China's just a smaller piece of that.
Boeing, I know that this is a big tourism year, a big cooperation apparently between the U.S. and China, trying to get Chinese citizens to visit here and Americans to visit China, which you would think would be good for O'Hare. And I don't know, we keep track of which airport is the busiest airport in the country, and it's back to Atlanta from O'Hare. Is that something we should be worried about?
Well, it's funny. I mean, you think, we're number one, and then if it's super busy, you can't get
right, exactly.
anywhere when you're actually at the airport. So I'm
kind
of rooting
for number seven. Yeah. I'll be number seven.
Yeah, where you have plenty of flights, but you could actually get to the gate. So, yeah, O'Hare did take the crown again in 2014 from Atlanta, but in 2015 again fell to second place in terms of the number of flights in the air from those airports. But if you look at the underlying trend, the number of passengers, Chicago's way behind and has been for quite some time. Atlanta, Hartsfield, Jackson, more than 96 million people moved through it in 2014, and O'Hare had 70 million that year, and it trailed even. And then LA was in number two with 71 million. So there are a lot of flights, but more people, more packed flights out of Atlanta.
I'm assuming you've been to the Atlanta airport.
Have yes.
Yeah, it's a very nice place,
mm-hmm.
big place. And Chicago is sort of like between LaGuardia and Hartsfield, I would say, right? I mean, Chicago is better than LaGuardia, clearly.
Yes,
but it's,
I would say.
Yeah. But I mean, so Meg's is better, and it's been closed for 10 years. But it still seems to be a little confined, and it just doesn't have the room to really expand the way Hartsfield is.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it does have a footprint that it has to abide by, pretty much. But, with
you can't go up. You can't grow
right,
up.
Right.
That'd be trouble.
United and American are actually flying bigger aircraft now, but flying them less. So, I mean, there is more capacity there when you increase the size of the planes.
Right. So that accounts for maybe some of the fewer flights.
Exactly.
How are things at Midway?
Well, Midway, the smaller airport, had 253,519 arrivals and departures in 2015. That's up almost 2% versus the year earlier. And they are the 26th busiest in the country. So, you can be a little mellower, except sometimes that security line stretches all the
at
way
Midway.
Back to baggage claim.
Well, they've been working on that, haven't they?
Yeah. No, I've had days when I breeze through there, and then I've had days where it's like, maybe tomorrow.
Frank Sennett from Crane Chicago Business, thanks for coming in today.
Thanks, Steve.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch. We're here on 720 WGN. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we will talk to the person behind this new startup in New York City. It's called Eat Offbeat. It's a cool idea. What they've done is they found recent refugees, many times from war-torn countries, who can cook. And cook their native food, and they've started this food delivery business, giving new people living in this country a way to make a living by cooking from their old country. That's coming up. It's 12:22. You're listening to the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. You know, there has been a lot of talk in this country over the past 6 weeks, well, maybe 6 years, maybe 16, but especially the last 6 or 8 weeks or so, about immigrants, refugees in this country. There are some, the governor in Illinois, the governor in Indiana, who've wanted to block refugees from coming in this country. Governors from some other states have indeed welcomed them and helped them to flourish. Well, whether you want them or not, they are here and they have a lot to offer. That is something that is well known to Manal Kahi. She's the co-founder and CEO of Eat Offbeat. It is a startup in New York City. And Manal, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
I hope by the time we're done talking, I can convince you to bring it here to Chicago as well.
Yeah, I hope so. We would love to, too.
All right, so tell me your story. You're here in this country for, about 2 years now from Lebanon, correct?
Correct. About 3 years. I came here in 2013.
Okay.
For a master's degree.
And your plans are to stay?
Sorry, can you say that again?
I said your plans are to stay here?
Yes. I'm planning to stay here. So we started this company about a few months ago.
And the idea is, and just to tell your story a little bit, you came here and you couldn't find a hummus that sort of met your standards, so you started making your own hummus. Your friends liked
exactly.
it. And then later, the refugees, you thought, well, this might be a way to sort of incorporate newly arrived people in this country to New York society, right?
Exactly. So when I started making my own hummus and people around me loved it, we thought that, hey, you know, with my co-founder, who's also my brother, we thought maybe we should sell it. And when we thought of someone who would better equipped than I to make, you know, great hummus or very authentic hummus, we thought of the Syrian refugees coming into the country. And this is where it started. But then, because we also wanted to discover other cuisines, and we knew that there's much more than just hummus, right, out there. We decided to make it a bit wider and to incorporate even people from all over the world. And that's what taught us to eat off these.
So the idea is you've got refugees in New York City making food that is native to them, to their homeland, and then
exactly.
making it available for purchase in New York. How do you find the refugees?
So we find the refugees through the International Rescue Committee. That's one of the main resettlement agencies in New York and in the U.S., actually. They are in charge of resettling refugees, and part of what they do is offer them employment, help them with finding employment. So they connect us to the refugees who are looking for jobs. They basically connect us to those who want to do something who are good home cooks
sure.
and who have very good skills in the kitchen.
So right now
they're not necessarily professional chefs. They're just people who have a passion for cooking.
Right now you've got refugees from Eritrea, Iraq, and Nepal working with you. Is that correct? And so you don't deliver to Chicago, I'm assuming.
No, not yet. We really hope so. We would love to.
Well, I like the idea, though. You're starting small, and two, it's like you only do takeout because you don't have the cash for brick and mortar, but you only do takeout orders. You're saying, let's do five or more servings because we're small and we really can't afford to spend all our time delivering single
exactly.
meals around Manhattan.
Exactly. So we're delivering right now for groups of five and over, but we're hoping that in the very near future, we're going to start doing actual individual deliveries.
I know that you say a lot
Good afternoon.
I know that you're saying that you're doing this for New Yorkers. You want to introduce them to
yes.
different cultures and food, and I get that, but I want to talk about the refugees a little bit, and I want you to share with me, I'm going to assume the light in their eyes when they discover that they can do this and that it can be a success for them.
So the first thing is that those we're working with, at least right now, our chefs are really passionate about cooking. So they were very happy that they had the chance to do that in a professional kitchen, right? Not only cook for their own family, but also cook for a wider audience. So that was the first thing that made them really proud. The other thing, and that's something that one of them actually mentioned to us, is that what we're doing actually gives them a place. Let's say it's their first experience where they don't have to adapt. So ever since they came here, they've had to adapt to a lot of things. They've had to adapt to the weather, they had to adapt to the culture and to everything. But this is the only place where they actually find that we or the customers are adapting to what they have to offer.
So it's a little bit of coming home for them.
That makes them. Yeah, exactly. Because they're cooking just the way they cook at home, and they don't have to adapt their recipes to our taste, right? We want to discover what they are making, so they just make it the way they make it, the way they like to make it.
And how's business?
It suits, of course we have to choose the recipes that are, the most adequate for New Yorkers or for our customers, but usually it so happens that these are, they're amazing recipes, and, you know, home food, it always brings something different from what you get at the restaurant, so from a business perspective, it also makes a lot of sense, especially that in New York, and I'm sure in Chicago too, there's a lot of people who want to discover something new and something very different. So this gives us a bit of an edge and an added value in what we offer.
Well,
we're doing is very authentic, and it's very different from what you get elsewhere.
Yeah, I like it. It's very genuine. It's very close to life. I think that's a pretty cool thing. And you've talked about expanding it. Seriously, do you think you might expand to other markets, and would Chicago ever be an expansion area?
Definitely. So we're still not very sure about where we would go, but
right.
we would pick places where there are refugees, of course, and this happens to be almost anywhere. But we also want places where there's a big community of what we call adventurous eaters, so people who want to discover something new and something different, people who go the extra mile to find this authenticity and who appreciate this authenticity. And I'm sure Chicago is one of those. It's on the list, definitely.
That's Manal Kahi, the co-founder, CEO of Eat Off Beat. And Manal, we talked for 5 minutes and didn't bring up snow at all. So I think that should be a source of pride for both of us.
Sorry, I didn't hear that.
I just figured you're in Manhattan, so all anyone's talking about is snow today, and I thought it might be a nice relief not to have to do that.
Exactly. Well, we're on our way to the kitchen, and it's been really tough to get there, actually, today. It's been a nightmare.
Well, good luck. Keep us posted with your progress. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for your interest.
You bet. You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thank you very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on this cloudy Monday afternoon in Chicago. But the sun is about to come out. The Chicago, Chicago boys are here. I'm not capable of getting that right, am I? I really practice, too. Chicago Inno boys. Will Flanagan and Jim Dahlke are here. Welcome to both of you men.
Thank you.
And it's not funny anymore. It's becoming embarrassing. But
no,
it's just,
I like it.
Because of it, we've bought the Inno Chicago domain as well, just to make sure.
If I was holding the thing, I even highlighted it. It's Chicago Inno. Okay. So we have not, the three of us, been together since we did the Great Christmas Extravaganza special, which people are still talking about.
A very Inno Christmas.
Right. And they're talking about it, not necessarily in a good way.
Oh.
But it's still on people's minds, which is nice.
We'll see you in a year.
Jim, explain for everyone, as we do each time, just exactly, Will Flanagan, what Chicago Inno is.
Definitely. Chicago Inno is a destination for accessible local conversations about the tech and innovation communities here. We're covering everything that's going on across all of tech, from student entrepreneurs all the way to Fortune 500 CEOs. We just want more people to know what's going on in city on that front.
And it is a remarkable spot, and it's a remarkable market for everything. You guys have opened my eyes up to so many things and some of the companies that we're going to be talking about in the next half hour or so. Okay, Will, Jim Dahlke is here, and he seems to be wearing a Carolina Panthers sweatshirt.
Yes.
Which makes me a little uncomfortable.
That's right. My Panthers had a pretty impressive win last night, and I would like to just let everyone in the Chicago area know that the bandwagon is open,
and we are
willing to take all Chicagoans on the Panther bandwagon.
You know, they're really not even that much fun to watch because, sometimes they let a team in at the end, but by and large, they're blowouts, and I sat down. I was ready to watch some football last night, and it was over before I got to the couch.
Well, you might see the same thing in a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
I think Noodle Arm Peyton Manning might be struggling against
that. That's fighting words. Okay, so we're talking football, though, for a reason. Because Scott Kleinberg from the Tribune writes about social media, and he's in a couple times a week. And he was talking last week about Facebook, how they're trying to make this new push to sort of rival Twitter when it comes to live commentary for sporting events.
Mm-hmm.
And you took that for a ride last night during the football game.
Yeah, I wanted to give it a test last night because I'm a big Twitter user during live events. Love kind of following along with the chatter in real time and seeing what's going on that second screen. And wanted to see if Facebook could really do that, because Facebook has always sort of been like that destination for status updates after the game. That's where you kind of go to celebrate your team's victory after the game. Not really a place you go for real-time updates and analysis. So Facebook introduced this new feature called Facebook Sports Stadium. Really interesting effort from Facebook. They basically has four tabs, a matchup tab to kind of give the live updates, what's going on play-by-play, a stats tab, which gives real-time stats for all the players and teams, and then experts and friends. So friends is a running list of everything that your Facebook friends are saying about that game, and experts is a curated list of analysts, media organizations, people who are covering the game. So it kind of gives you a really big breadth of information.
So it's not like Twitter, where anyone could post at a hashtag and you would be reading it. Instead, these are your friends only.
Right. So it's your friends, but it's also people that Facebook deems are experts.
Sure,
in a separate tab. So yeah, there's a lot kind of presented to you in this. And it was a really ambitious effort. And I enjoyed using it, but it did not for me meet up to that experience of using Twitter. For Twitter, I've been sort of for years sort of refining my Twitter follows and following people who are really funny and weird and interesting and provide the analysis during games that I really like. And Facebook didn't quite reach that with Sports Stadium.
Yeah, there's so much noise on Facebook. So this is one of their first attempts at a product to just make that noise a little more clear. And it's going to take a while. Twitter was built around the idea of, like, only follow the noise you want to hear. Facebook is get it all. So it's basically a filtering tool.
Well, wait,
it's interesting.
Then maybe I don't understand Twitter then, because what I like from your description is it's sort of like I'm in my family room with all my friends commenting on the game, whereas when I'm with Twitter, I'm in the family room with the rest of the world commenting on the game.
And the biggest problem with that is that my friends weren't talking enough about it.
Right.
There wasn't enough chatter around the people that I was Facebook friends with about the game. The nice thing about Twitter is that I get a new opinion and a new take and a new meme and a new GIF and a new something funny and interesting every second. Every time I refresh the Twitter page, it's something new going on with that game. Facebook doesn't have that immediacy quite yet. And it was a great effort with Facebook Sports Data, and I'm really excited to see how they tweak it and it kind of expand it to different games. I enjoyed using it. I actually think we wrote it in a post on Chicago Inno today that it's a bigger rival to the ESPN app than to Twitter, actually, because the features like matchup and stats are really what ESPN apps gives you. It's those play-by-play. It's the ongoing statistical analysis. But with Twitter, you kind of get that already.
And Steve, Facebook's your living room. Twitter is your ideal living room. Twitter is your living room with your friends. And, maybe I will add Colin Cowherd and this comedian and this celebrity. So Twitter is like the perfect living room you would want to watch this game with.
Right. And so Facebook is for guys like me who don't really ever get out and don't really want to meet new people.
Yeah. I think they're working on that.
So Facebook's giving Twitter a run, and Twitter's they're having a little trouble, right? They're in a
Twitter has stuff. Its own problems. I mean, I'm sure they weren't paying too close attention to how Sports Stadium was doing.
Just the three who were shown the door.
Exactly. It's amazing. I mean, it's funny. Executive turmoil has kind of become a part of Twitter's brand. That's just like, as one source said, as all this news was leaking about several top executives leaving, it's just Twitter being Twitter. So last night, it surfaced that seven of the company's top executives, head of product, head of media, head of engineering, are leaving. It's another shakeup. Twitter investors are worried its shares are near an all-time low for the company. They're announcing their Q4 earnings next week, and everyone's really nervous. Mm-hmm. So now you add Facebook getting into the real-time game. You add executive shakeups. It's just there hasn't been a lot of good news for Twitter in the past couple months.
They're down 64% today. I think that's 1.5% or so. So the idea then is that whether these people were fired or whether they were shown the door, right? The CEO is on today tweeting out, no, you guys have it wrong. They weren't fired. They all left voluntarily and everything's going to be hunky-dory. Do we believe that?
That's tough to say. I mean, the interesting thing about it, though, is that Jack Dorsey, the new CEO, I mean, he didn't hire any of these people. These were all under the previous CEO's hires, Dick Costello. So really, I mean, if you're going to take a glass half-full approach with this, Jack Dorsey is going to bring in his own guys.
So this is like a new general manager hiring a new coach, maybe.
Yeah. Basically, yeah. I mean, these are really important positions. I mean, VP of product. I mean, these are really important roles that need to be filled at Twitter, and Jack is going to kind of do that himself.
That's Jim Dahlke. Will Flanagan here as well from Chicago Inno. We're going to take a break, check the latest numbers, and we'll get right back to these two boys. You're listening to The Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. You're listening to The Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. All right, Will Dahlke, Will Flanagan and Jim Dahlke are here from Chicago Inno. And if you listen to us regularly, you know why I'm laughing, because I was focusing so much on saying Chicago Inno instead of Inno Chicago.
We'll do name tags.
Yeah, just I'm doomed. I can't read. I can't
see
that far
anywhere.
Chicago Inno is a really cool site if you're interested in what's coming up in the market here when it comes to innovation and technology. And a couple of cool guys. I just like when you guys come in. One of the things you've written about recently is this Open Grid in Chicago. I've read about it, and I'm still not quite sure I understand it. So tell me about Open Grid.
Totally. I'll break it down for you. So Open Grid is really cool. So the city of Chicago gets open data rights. So the city collects a ton of data, whether that's manually by just, you know, putting in a lot of information online or through sensors. They're collecting data from when plows are being released, the amount of sewage in the Chicago River, government salaries. They're just taking all of this in. And for the past 5 years, all of that data has been accessible via something called the city data portal. And that was great. It was over 500 data sets where civic technologists could go in, grab that data, and make really cool apps out of it. But what OpenGrid is it takes all that data and it not just makes it available, but it makes it accessible. So you can go on there and you as a resident can use it to see, you know, what are the open building permits in my neighborhood? What are the new stores launching?
Is it hard to find out what you can find out?
No, it's super easy. It makes it very to see here are the sets you can search, here are the type of things you can look for. Here's what we want you exploring. It's basically we're collecting all of this data. We want you to use it to learn about your neighborhood, your city, all of the offerings we have. So it takes all of this information that was available for developers and programmers and just gives it to the resident because data can be available. That's easy. It's making it accessible, which is really hard. And the city's done a really good job with that.
Is this the sort of thing that's actually going to be used by people?
I think so. I mean, that's the hope, at least. I mean, Chicago's done a lot of really interesting things as far as making the city a smart city. I mean, you look at the array of things which is going on that started at the University of Chicago, which is putting nodes around the city to kind of be like a Fitbit for the city. There's a lot of initiatives that are going on in the city of Chicago that are really, really leading the country as far as smart city initiatives. And the Open Grid is just a way to make all that information we're collecting super accessible.
All right, let's talk food then. Tavola? Did I say that correctly?
Yes, you got it.
All right. So what is Tavola?
Tavola is a really interesting startup out of the University of Chicago, actually, as well, that won the New Venture Challenge last summer. And the New Venture Challenge is a really prestigious competition.
It's not easy, is it?
No, it's not. Yeah.
Words are hard.
And some of the winners in the past have been Grubhub and Braintree and a lot of really influential tech companies that come out of there. And they won that, and they got a $500,000 investment recently. And it's a really interesting machine and startup. It's kind of like a cooking device that sits on your kitchen countertop. And
we talked about this before?
So we have. It was called Maestro previously. Okay. So they've rebranded and changed a little bit. They were sort of the Keurig for food, and they've shifted direction a little bit. They're no longer pods, but they've got meals basically that they deliver to you. You put them in this machine, you scan it, sends the information up to the cloud, and knows exactly how to cook your food. So whether that's a boiling, steaming, just sort of convection heat, it knows exactly what kind of food you've got in there, and it will cook it appropriately.
Okay, so wait a minute. So it's not a pod like a Keurig coffee cup, but
correct.
It's food that comes in a packet, and it can do anything from baking it to boiling it to
steaming it to just convection heat. Basically it can recognize the type of food that's been delivered and that you want to put in, and then we'll cook it based on what the meal is.
Is it a giant piece of equipment? I don't quite get how it can either boil.
Picture a microwave.
Maybe a little bit bigger. It's not a huge piece of machinery. It just kind of sits right on your countertop, right next to your toaster, right next to your microwave.
Yeah, and what's really exciting about these guys and this device is that not only did they win the New Venture Challenge, which birthed Grubhub, they also this seed rounds came from the same investors of Grubhub. So it's starting to share a lot of the same DNA from one of the city's most successful food companies. So again, that's not saying like put those two things together and here's our next Grubhub. But even the thought that you know it's in its earlier stage and it's starting to show those same signs, that's a huge deal for the ecosystem, and we're excited to watch them.
Why for the ecosystem?
Well, because man, you add a tech pillar, like Grubhub changed, you know, the city startup ecosystem. It was a company that came. It was recognizable. It was a B2C company. So Tavola, like, people get excited about it. Oh, it's a cool food tech device. Those successes are huge. I love when B2B companies do well. I love when any, you know, new startup does well. But this is one that people are going to get. Like, oh, this
it could
new
change
machine
the way
was
eat.
Built in Chicago. Yeah.
Right. Okay. One more. Blitzy.
That's right. Yeah, Blitzy is
No, Blitzy. It just sounds silly.
Blitzy.
Say it one more time.
Yeah,
come on.
It's
1, 2, 3. Blitzy.
That's right. Yeah, they are a startup that launched in around 2011, and they are an online site for discounted arts and craft supplies. So basically think, you know, your Joann's or whatever store you have to go in to get craft supplies. They do that at a super discounted rate online. So based here in Chicago, just today announced they raised $6.2 million. Actually from a German-based media group. So it's really interesting to see what they're doing and how fast they're growing in Chicago.
Yeah, less than 6 months after they raised a $3 million Series A. So you think like, oh, an online marketplace for craft supplies, you know, go get them. But that's a huge market.
Yeah, you know what? Actually, when you were talking about it off the air, I was thinking of people who made crafts. and that they were selling their crafts. But no, these are for people who want to make crafts and can buy their material. Is that are they up and running now?
Yeah, they've been up and running for a number of years.
Yeah, they sell in over 70 countries, and I think a stat that I read today was that over 90% of their customers are coming back and buying again.
So you really you can get felt for days.
Yeah, there you go.
Go to Blitzy.com.
That's it. They've built a great community.
Will Flanagan and Jim Dahlke, good to see you guys from Chicago Inno, and I hope we can do it again as long as I don't insult you. Is there a limit how many insults before you stop coming back?
You're not
back?
Even close to no? that limit. We're always good. Coming back.
Something to shoot for next week. You're listening to The Business Lunch here on 720 WGN.